Hi, friends.
Hello, should I delete that, listeners?
We still have some tickets left for our live tour and we would absolutely love to see you there.
On Thursday, the 23rd of May, we will be performing in the London Islington Assembly Hall.
On Monday, the 27th of May, we will be in Salford.
On Tuesday, the 28th of May, we'll be in Glasgow.
Sunday, the 2nd of June, Birmingham.
Monday, the 3rd of June, Bristol.
And Tuesday, the 4th of June in Southampton.
You can get your tickets at aegpresents.co.uk or via the link in the show notes or our Instagram bios.
We really hope we see you there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm not mad. My responses in my brain have been incredibly appropriate to living in this world that doesn't really want me to accept me for myself.
Hello and welcome back to Should I Delete That? I'm Alex Light.
I'm Em Clarkson and I am so excited. We've got a repeat guest
we
today.
We do.
Bryony Gordon has come back to talk to us again after publishing her book, Mad Woman.
Mad Woman follows on from Mad Girl, which she wrote 10 years ago, detailing her mental health struggles. And in this, she talks about her OCD, her progress with her OCD, and also her more recent struggle with binge eating.
She is opening up a conversation that is so desperately needed right now. And we were so grateful to her for coming to talk to us today. So without further ado, please enjoy the interview. Hello, Bryony. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah.
A two-timer.
I'm like thrilled. Is that, do you have lots of two-timers?
We do not.
Not many.
No, we do not many. We do not often do repeat guests. But
I'm in the two-timer club.
The two-timer club.
My day.
It's pretty prestigious.
Forget about day. It's made my
I'm
better.
Glad.
Thank
yes,
you.
Thank you. And you're here because you have just published a new book, which we are really excited to talk to you about. I made no secret of it last time we spoke to you. I love your books. I've read them all. I have a quite new baby. So give me like a few minutes to get this one finished, but I started it.
I've got a quite new baby who's going to be 11 in 2 weeks, and I'm still using that as an excuse.
Thank you, that helped. So your new book, Mad Woman, can you tell us about it, please?
Yeah, I mean, it's a follow-up to this book I wrote nearly 10 years ago called Mad Girl, which was all about my experiences of mental illness and about specifically about OCD. So I wrote about, so we all hear all the time, people say I'm a little bit OCD, and people always would say to me, oh, you should see my sock drawer. And I'm like, why is it always the sock drawer? Like, I don't have a sock drawer. My husband sort of jokes, he wishes I had the good type of OCD, but there is no good type of OCD. But I wrote this book about the reality of OCD for me, which is that this kind of subset of it known as puro, which is very common, but people don't talk about it because it involves lots of intrusive thoughts. And so my brain from childhood told me that maybe I was a serial killing paedophile who'd like blanked out in horror. So you can see why like people don't go, I'm a bit OCD. Sometimes my brain tells me that I might hurt some. I'm not, by the way, I'm not. I just want to be clear that I am not a serial killing paedophile.
Thank you so much for that clarification.
But I would say that.
Can I just say, like, the fact that I can make jokes about this is like really revolutionary for me.
And the thing about OCD is it's so common. It's really common as well in mothers postpartum. So we know that most mental illnesses, if you're going to experience mental illness in your life, something like 60 to 70% of people, you will have experienced it by the age of 14. The rest of that, the 40, 30% or whatever that won't, are people that experience, say, PTSD because of things that they've experienced, or mums postpartum. And OCD is a really common thing that horrifies new mums, because they're like, I'm supposed to love this baby, and instead I'm terrified that I might do something terrible to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so writing about it was really important. Mad Woman is a kind of follow-up to that, of all the things I've learned in the preceding 10 years since kind of talking so openly about my mental health, I guess. That's not answered your question at all.
I've enjoyed it.
So I've just gone off on one, on a different thing. But so Mad Woman, I wanted to write about, I wrote about OCD, I got sober, I launched this podcast, and like my first guest was Prince Harry, and I ran marathons in my pants. And, you know, on the face of it, it looked really like, wow, she's got her shit together. And then the kind of pandemic, and I felt that. And then the pandemic happened, and I started to unravel in sort of slowly in different ways. For me, I realised I wasn't drinking, obviously, but my addiction had sort of reared up its head in a way to like my first ever addiction, which was food.
Right.
And I developed binge eating disorder, and I was really ashamed of that, because I thought I'd sort of done a lot of work on myself and my body image. But anyway, and then also all this sort of stuff has happened in the last 4 years. So I also have gone through quite an early menopause, and the OCD came back really badly. And I learned a lot about the effect of hormones on my mental health. And I basically wanted to write all about it. Write about it. So the Mad Woman in the title is like, yeah, you're damn right I'm mad. I'm fucking furious that women have to put up with this shit. And it's kind of, we're ignored and we're dismissed. And the sort of subtitle is how to survive in a world that wants you to think you're the problem. And that's very much been my sort of experience over the last few years, is realizing actually I'm not mad. My responses in my brain have been incredibly appropriate to living in this world that doesn't really want me to accept me for myself, if that makes, as I am. You know, I have never felt confident enough or thin enough or strong enough, or, you know, I've never kind of fit that sort of version of a woman that I suppose was always up on billboards, you know, on the cover of magazines throughout our childhood. And I realised that, of course, I've had eating disorders, of course, I've had OCD, of course, I've had depression, of course, all of these things, because I live in a society, I live in a patriarchal society that doesn't want me to just accept myself as I am. Hmm. So that's what Mad Woman's about.
Yeah.
Very light.
So much I want to talk to you about.
And so I wrote that book, and now I'm sitting here talking to you about it.
Oh, there's so much. I don't know where to start. There's so much. I mean, the intrusive thoughts. I think we spoke about this in another episode. Postpartum intrusive thoughts are intense, aren't they?
Yeah.
Really intense.
How are you finding?
Hard, yeah. I mean, I've always had intrusive thoughts. And postpartum has been, yeah, it's been crazy, to the point where I've had to like really, really have a word with myself and calm myself down. At one point I was like obsessed with this marble coffee table that we've got in the living room. I just became obsessed with thinking this thing was going to happen to my son, like some, and I was like, we need to move the coffee table to my husband. And he was like, we need to get through this. We're not moving. He's fine. You know, we can, and it's fine. I'm past that now. The coffee table's there and stuff. Anyway, I don't know why I'm making this about me.
No, but this is interesting. And this is why I talk about this stuff, because it makes me feel like less of a, like, you know, in a way my books are like, they've been a kind of a thing of like out of desperation, me going, I have these thoughts, I have these feelings, I've heard other people do too, but obviously none of us go around with like badges on going, I have intrusive thoughts that tell me I might be a serial killing paedophile. And I'm like, so if you have these thoughts, do you want to congregate around this book and we can talk about them and we can feel like we're not freaks, you know, or that we're not mad, or we are mad and that's okay, but we're not bad.
Yeah.
You know, so it's really important that you say that, and that will help a lot of people listening.
Yeah, and you wrote an article recently, didn't you, about it?
Yeah.
That I read that made me feel so much better. And it's great now because there's like stuff on TikTok, like videos on TikTok of like, intrusive thoughts I had after becoming
but also,
a mom.
We all have intrusive thoughts. Like, this is the thing. We all have.
Do we?
Yes. Everyone has intrusive thoughts. So OCD is sort of about the attention you pay to those thoughts. So yeah. I think that's sort of estimated that we all have something like 60,000 thoughts a day. Some days I have way more than that. Sometimes I have way less than that.
No wonder I'm exhausted.
Depends
that's a lot
on,
of thoughts.
It depends on the... But so we are not all of our thoughts,
Who
right?
counted those?
I don't know how they measured this, right?
Jesus.
But the whole thing is that... So we all have that thought, you know, like you're on the tube or and you're like, what if I was to just push someone in front of the train?
I had that thought this morning. I didn't think I was going to push them. I thought, what if they push them?
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. Thankfully, because I don't trust myself. But someone, I saw another man, I thought he's going to push her, and then he didn't. But it was horrific.
Or like, you go to a party and someone hands you their baby and you're like, what if I just threw the baby on the floor?
Yeah.
But most people go... Obviously, I'm not going to do that. And they just dismiss it and they get on with their day. Someone with this type of OCD will be so distressed by the thoughts that they will ruminate on them again and again to check they're not the thoughts. Right. So like the more attention you give to them, the more power they have over you. So it's a really hard sort of catch-22 situation. I now go, that's an intrusive thought, that's an intrusive thought. And that gives me the kind of like break moment to kind of go, okay, this is OCD, you know. But it's sort of cunning. It'll shapeshift and it'll come at me in different ways. You know, it'll tell me I'm a bad person because of something else, something at work or, you know, and I have to be kind of constantly on guard for it. But yeah, it's a really common thing. And I actually think that it's a really appropriate thing. So the mad woman, I sort of had this idea that actually, what if the mad among us are actually the most sane? And that kind of came to me during the pandemic when I realized I was in a clinical depression and I looked around and for the first time I felt like everyone else was too, you know. And because usually you just think you're the worst person, it's just you, all of that. And I sort of thought, well, that's appropriate, isn't it? Because we're in lockdowns and we're not being able to connect with people. Actually, it's kind of, it's appropriate to be depressed. And I suddenly thought, what if lots of mental illnesses were actually a really appropriate response of our brains to try and keep us safe or try to alert us to something going on in the world? And when you look at OCD in those terms shortly after, you know, in motherhood, if you think about it, you're suddenly responsible for this other human, you know, and so your brain is going into kind of, it employs whatever it can to keep that human safe, you know. So these are like extreme sort of brain mechanisms in a way for you to do your job. So actually... It's kind of, it makes a kind of twisted amount of sense.
It does. When you put it like that, actually, it makes a whole lot of sense, which makes it feel a lot better and less scary.
Yeah, it's like, well, of course you want to, you're, and it's just an extreme version. It's like your brain's just gone that little bit too far. But it's not, but even it hasn't gone that far. Like, even let's not judge it. Let's not give it that judgment. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's working in a primitive way because you're tired, you're full of hormones, you've just gone through a major life change. It's doing what, your brain is doing what it's beautifully evolved to do, which is protect, keep things safe. And so your brain's going, okay, I need to keep baby safe. Marble coffee table. Need to keep baby safe. Bleach. What if I was to, I need to get rid, you know, it's all of that. Yeah. Knives, all of those things, you know, it's like, it's kind of, you're hypervigilant. And that to me is what OCD is. It's kind of constantly scanning the environment to check that I'm safe and to check that I'm okay. And crucially to check that I'm a good person. I'm a good girl.
Mm. Right. Is that the crux of your OCD?
I think it is. I think like at first when I wrote about OCD, it was about like saying to people, look, I'm not bad. Because that's what OCD, I think, it tells me I'm like the worst person in the world. And actually, I think the other sort of element of mad woman is wanting to go, Well, actually, sometimes I am bad, and that's okay.
Mm. Right.
How do you cope with the with the external commentary on? Because you put yourself out there in such a way, and you're so vulnerable to talk about these things in the way that you do, and at the Telegraph, and like in your books and everything. And you know, like you've done, even the promo for the books, it puts you out in front of a new audience. Mm. How do you then cope with people who misunderstand you or take issue with what you say or whatever? You know, the internet's like just full of assholes. Like, how do you cope with that?
I find that people don't tend to misunderstand. Mm. You know, actually, my experience is the reason I talk about this stuff and the reason I write about it is because when you do that, it sort of untangles that sort of all of those misunderstandings and that and the misinformation about this stuff. I tend not to focus on the people that don't get it and the people that don't have any interest in getting it and the people that see people like me as a kind of way to make themselves feel better, if you get what I mean.
But it's amazing that you can have that perspective when you're so much of your like anxiety, I guess, is about like being your perception. Sorry, people, you know, you want to be perceived as not bad or as good.
Yeah.
You're amazing then for being able to take criticism or trolling or whatever you want to call it.
But I also think that, like, so there's this other, you know, negative bias. It makes us focus on the trolls, right? Yeah. But in reality, 98%, 99% of people wish you well. And actually, here's the revelatory thing. They're not fucking thinking about me.
Yeah.
I know. I'm like, what?
What could you possibly be thinking about?
How rude. I realise I focus a lot. I can, you know, obviously, when you get someone emailing you and telling you that you're fat and useless and all of that stuff, you can go, oh. And then it's like, I sit and I think, oh my God, like just for a moment, shall we try and work out how tragic your life would have to be to be like, I'm going to sit down.
I'm going to email Brian and
email this person and tell them what I think about the way they look. And it's like, oh no, I feel like, I feel really sorry for that person because I would never in my, you know, like I just wouldn't do that. So I kind of tend to switch it around. I've got much better at doing that thing of like, oh, what someone else thinks about me says more about, I mean, you're very good at this, Em. What someone else thinks about me says more about them than it does about me. Like, what other people think of me is none of my business.
But it's amazing that you have that, like, awareness and this real conviction.
But I've had to fight for that.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't just wake up one morning and go, oh, what other people think of me is none of my business.
Yeah.
Like, when someone said that to me in, like, my first year of sobriety, right? Mm. So that was, like, we're coming up for 7 years ago, right? And they said, yeah, what other people think of you is none of your business. And I was like, no, what do you mean? It's my only business. Like, the people pleaser in me is, like, I want everyone to just be happy. I don't want them to be upset by, I really don't want them to be upset by me or hurt by me or to think badly of me in any way. And it's still the greatest struggle on a day-to-day basis to go, okay, sometimes people will be pissed off with you, Bryony. People will be annoyed with you and that's okay because that's their... Those are the. I mean, I'm not going out hurting people. I'm making, you know, we were talking about something earlier, but like, I'm a grown woman who's entitled to make decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, how other people respond to those decisions is kind of, it's up to them.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any
sense.
No,
it does.
Totally.
But like,
it's
hard.
Great
that you've
and
got
it's,
that.
But it is really hard. And like, I don't want anyone to think that. It's not just something I've fought hard for over time. It's something I fight hard for every day.
Right.
You know, and it's not an easy fight. It's like today, my whole day, and look, it's like 12:15, right? And already I would say a good 3 hours of today, and I've only been up since 6:30. So we're talking about like 50% of my time today has been spent panicking that I've upset someone, that I'm in trouble, that someone's going to come and, like, some mad conspiracy theorist. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, you know. And I have to go, no, Bryony, it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always struck by the fact that you are able to keep communicating this and do so in the face of, it's like in the face of your biggest fear. It's like if the anxiety is being perceived badly, the fact that you're allowing yourself to be perceived by so many people is just really brave. It's just really cool.
It's brave, but it's kind of what I have to do because I don't know what's the other option.
But yeah, you're right. That's your only option, really.
It's hard,
all of
though,
our
isn't
only
it?
Option. Yeah, we just kind of have. It's like, yeah.
But don't you think hard. As well? I think that everyone thinks they're the worst person in the world. Most people, their default setting is.
Do you think men all think that?
No, maybe they don't.
No, I don't think. I think if we got Alex in here now and said, "Do you think you're the worst?" He'd be like, "Absolutely not. I guess I'm great."
No, but I mean, like, I think the bottom line is we all exist in a state of sort of like guilt and self-loathing.
Yeah,
maybe we don't.
I think we've been conditioned to.
Well, I mean, I do. I remember when I first started therapy, which was for my eating disorder, but obviously you end up looking at everything. And I genuinely believe that I was evil. That's the word that I used because that's what I thought. I thought I was evil. Like that was my.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just took it quite deep, didn't I?
No, I was
quite,
so no, nice.
Quite dark.
I think we've taken it.
Yeah.
I don't think you need to worry about taking it.
But like, that's
deep
so weird because, I mean, no one ever told me I was evil. I don't know where that, you know.
So there's, okay, so apparently there's a theory as to why we turn on ourselves, right? Which is, and again, it's all an evolutionary response of survival, right? So when we are tiny, tiny babies, so back before we even remember or have memory, right?
Yeah.
Say you're a baby, and you'll know this. Having babies, okay, is that the baby is lying there crying in the cot, right? And for whatever reason, you're on the phone, you're on the loo, or whatever, you can't come to the baby because it's not because you're being a terrible human, it's because, you know, or you're in a bit of the house where you can't hear them, or I don't know, whatever. The baby, for survival, has to know that you're gonna come. Because otherwise it would just die. It would be like, I'm going to die. I'm going to die because the person's not coming to feed me.
This is not what Alex needs to hear right now.
So then as a kind of survival thing, it's like they go, the babies go, this is, I think it was Gabor Mate who I read this. They say, oh, it's okay. They are coming. It's my fault that, you know, it's not that they're to blame. But, like, they're not to blame.
Oh, shit, the baby's
for
take
not
responsibility. The baby,
even without
realising
it.
Right, well, I'm never putting Arlo down again.
I know.
But this is why, it's like a primitive thing to keep us alive. Because otherwise, the moment a baby was like, it would be terrified every time. Like, a baby just knows, I'm going to cry, and it's okay if the baby does, if the, you know, it's like a weird kind of self-protective thing that we carry through. And it serves us in childhood, doesn't serve us when we're 43.
Yeah, okay. That seems like a real design fault that they don't give you like a switch or something that you can just sort of recalibrate.
But it's not like,
as an
I don't
adult.
Think like the baby just is like, oh, you know, it's got, there's a reason the mum can't come, and it can't be that the mum's at fault, it has to be that I'm at fault.
But it's not their fault. This is awful.
I know.
This is fucking awful.
I love him and I love his work. But that did scare me, that, because I was like, okay, so my son makes a noise, I'm like, don't hate yourself. It's
no,
not,
but
it's not you. It's not
parenting
your fault.
As I love well, you. Is that we can't, like, the other thing is, like, I hate to break it to you, right? We will fuck our kids up. We just will.
I know.
And us fucking our kids up is how our kids get to go on their own magical fucking journeys.
Yeah.
That's true.
And I'm not,
that's a good
like,
point.
I don't actively think, how can I fuck my child up this morning so that she can go on her own magical journey?
I'm going to give her crabble for breakfast.
Discovery. But, you know, every morning I try and be the best parent I am, but I will make mistakes. And, you know, the mistakes that my, you know, like, I've got to the stage now where I'm like, you know, I'm like, oh, thank God my parents, didn't talk about mental health or whatever, because, I mean, it was not their fault, it was part of the generation, but I've got to go on this
got to learn,
magical journey.
Yeah, okay, that helps a bit.
Yeah, that is actually, that's not quite like, a nice way of looking
at it. But also,
I
really, like, my job as a parent is not, is like, is also, we want to make our, we want our children just to be happy. Like, there's that phrase in there that you're only as
happy as your
happy
least,
as
your
child, least happy child, whatever. and like, but the whole thing is I don't, like, but kids will become unhappy. And this is at the core of all the conversations about
that
mental health.
That actually puts a lot of pressure on the kids, can I just say? Because my mum always said that to me. Like, so it's like, well, I've got to be happy, then otherwise you won't be happy.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a bit fucked up, because it's like, well, brilliant. So now I've got to plaster a smile on it, because otherwise you'll be sad and then I'll feel guilty that you're sad. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's just unclogged all my shit. Yeah.
So like, well, when, brilliant. And like, if you think back to when you were a kid, it's like, don't cry, don't be silly. No, do cry, let it all out, I say to my daughter.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's like we teach kids how to be happy. We teach them about happily ever after. But actually what we really need to be doing is teaching them how to be sad. Because that's where resilience comes in.
Yeah.
You can't wrap... We can't wrap our children as much as we want to.
Yeah, that's so true.
Like, if it was up to me, my child would be in a bubble...
Of joy.
Forever. Like, she's not allowed phone until she's 45. You know, she's attached to me.
Yeah.
Like, I would have her with me right now, sitting on my lap, and she's going to be 11 in 2 weeks.
Oh. That's exactly where she should be. You're right.
And but, like, God, that's not, like, she doesn't want to be there. Yeah.
That's so true. We need to teach them how to be sad. That's so true. Because they are going to be sad at some point. Like, that's... Yeah. Shit, man. So we're going to be sad. You know, that thing, you're only as happy as your most unhappy child. But, like, I feel like I'm also, like, only as happy as my most unhappy sibling and most unhappy parent as well. Never ends.
God, you're a real empath, aren't you?
Or codependent.
Possibly.
We're all thinking it.
Yeah, but more likely, yeah.
Yeah, I guess...
Never ends.
It might do, though, if you do the work.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Bothered.
Yeah.
But can I ask, can I like pull us back from like fucking up our kids? I would really, you touched on it before about lockdown and about binge eating. And I think this is like I think of all your work, this bringing this conversation will touch so many people because it's so prevalent and so under talked about. And I feel like societally we've got a lot better awareness now around sort of eating disorders, I guess, in the context of like how we typically view, like, you know, if you think of an eating disorder, we imagine an anorexic person. And I think to open up the conversation in the way that you have has just been so amazing. But it would be really great if you could tell us about kind of like, I guess, discovering that binge eating was what you were doing and seeking help and kind of working through that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wasn't really aware, you know, like, I think most, there was like an element of denial. I just thought, oh, this is just something I'm doing to, you know, I think also as an alcoholic in recovery, when the pandemic hit, I was like 2.5 years sober. And for me, the most important thing was don't pick up a drink. Mm. Don't pick up a drink. So I think I was like, I was like, there's a saying in recovery, which is you deal with whatever's going to kill you first, you know, and alcohol and cocaine were those things. And I suppose, yeah, I was so sort of terrified by what was happening. And And I started to sort of eat in the middle of the night. I mean, it was always in the middle of the night. It was never like during the day. But I was eating really strange things, like basically like raw chorizo, cooking chorizo. And, you know, I was kind of coming to, it was almost like an alcoholic blackout. You know, towards the end, this is making me feel exactly as alcohol and drugs did towards the end of my drinking and drugging. And it was really like a way, yeah, I would come round and there'd be like packets of hula hoops in the bed next to me rather than my husband, you know.
That's what you should have called your book.
But I was writing this book about sort of mental health and how to access mental health care. And I was interviewing this eating disorders expert, and she was talking about anorexia and bulimia. And of course, I have some experience of bulimia. I suffered from it in my 20s. And she said, oh, can you also talk about binge eating disorder? Because that's actually, we think, probably the most common eating disorder out there. And it's just not spoken about. And I sort of went, oh my God, that's what I'm doing. I think because I wasn't purging, I sort of thought, oh, that's okay. You know, you're not engaged in bulimia. But actually, I was still doing the binging part, you know. Mm. And I was needing to numb out in some way, you know. Still that thing of like sitting with uncomfortable feelings is just like completely like fucking wild to me, you know. And I was like, oh, fuck, this is what's going on, you know. Oh, God, another thing I'm going to have to deal with. But although, and actually when I thought about it, I thought, oh, actually, this was probably the first thing that I ever, like food was the first thing I used to kind of change the way I feel. Back when I was a kid, I used to like eat Herta Frankfurters from the fridge. I mean, I don't know why it's meat. It was never like, could have been something more conventional, like sugar and sweets and, you know, all of that. Yeah. But anyway. So, yeah, and I kind of see it as like it was almost a privilege to be able to get to the food stuff because I had to clear the alcohol and the drugs out of the way, you know. And there was a bit of my brain, there was a lot of my brain that was like, oh, another thing that's wrong with you, Bryony. People are bored with hearing about your fucking mental health issues, you know, which I realized was like the voice of like depression and eating disorders and whatever in itself. But like I realized actually it's not like, in a way, it is a privilege to be able to get to these things because I had to get sober. And then it was like, we talk about like peeling off layers of the onion, you know? Yeah. And it was like, oh, here's another layer coming off. Here's another thing I have to address. But I wanted to write about it because when I first spoke about it on Instagram, I got so many messages from women saying, I think I have this too. And I'm so ashamed because I've put on weight. Mm. It was always about the weight. You know? And I was like, this is not a weight issue. This is a soul issue. And if you go into treatment for binge eating disorder and your only aim is to lose weight, you're never going to get better. Because what we know as well is that, you know, diet culture, I mean, I don't need to tell you guys this. Diet culture keeps us in this sort of pattern of restricting, binging, restricting, binging, restricting, binging. So even if you don't have an eating disorder, you know, we all of us would probably admit to some extent, you know.
Yeah, cheat day and treats and like all the language that we use.
Whereas it's just like, it's just food. Yeah. Like, and for me, I know, like, as long as I'm using food to nourish myself as opposed to punish myself in some way, I'm okay. Do you know what I mean? But like I was using it to punish myself, you know, we were just talking about Oprah Winfrey coming out and talking about how she's judged for being overweight and then she's judged for losing weight, you know. And for me, so much of what I do is about going, regardless of my weight, which is none of your business how much I weigh, do you know what I mean? I'm still a human and I'm still as worthy as someone over there who's smaller than me. Mm-hmm. You know, and someone over there who's bigger than me is as worthy as I am, you know? It's like, can we stop looking at people and judging them from a lens of their bodies? Because it's kind of like, it actually makes the problem worse. And if you really want people to be healthy and happy, which I don't think people do, I think people want to have, I think, larger people provide a very good sort of, if they didn't exist, some other group of people would have to be maligned or whatever.
Mm.
You know, people don't, I get emails all the time from people going, I'm doing this like running challenge and people are like, this is going to be terrible for your joints. I'm concerned about them. I'm like, you don't give a shit about my fucking joints. Like, also there's no evidence whatsoever, by the way, that running has any impact on joints.
But that's so fucking fascinating that people do that.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, you don't care. All you care about is having someone to make yourself feel better.
Yeah. Yes. No one said that to me about my joints. I think that's really telling. It's just
I'm like, oh my God, you are obsessed with my joints.
It's
and the thing is, and I do have to really, like, I've had this like tendonitis thing and my brain goes,
yeah, you don't
it's because it's you're fat.
And no. I'm like,
no, it's because you've been running fucking 50 miles a week.
But it has really concerned as well. Like, you're doing two marathons and running between two cities. Like, these people could not even run for the bus and they're sending you this message, like, really genuinely got this.
But this is the thing,
but
like,
why?
It's that thing of, like, because we need people to judge, and women historically have already stepped in and gone, hey, yeah, I'll be that, yeah, like, we'll judge us, come on.
Yeah.
And I'll just go along with it and be like, okay, I make to make myself smaller so they don't judge
me.
Or they at least judge me in a nice way.
Yeah, because they're like, concerned about me.
Fuck that.
We take it as constructive criticism.
But like, I just, yeah. So, you know, for me, it's like, I want to be visible, but on my terms. And I don't want you, you know, I just think the energy we put into obsessing about some figure on a set of bathroom scales is like, imagine, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this and I won't be the last, hopefully, but like, imagine what we could do if we didn't have that, you know.
Do you cope with, or how do you, like, what's the recovery, I don't even know, process, when you don't focus on your weight, when obviously it comes, you're trying to recover within a culture that does prioritise it, like you say, how do you focus on recovery from something that is just intrinsically linked to weight? Do you know what I mean? Because you do see changes in your own body. And like, how do you manage to separate that? Because I think that's the thing with binge eating that people, that makes it so difficult to recover from is not just the stigma, but there's just the idea of recovering without being affected by the weight just seems really complicated.
Mm.
How do you
navigate
that?
I think it is, but I mean, again, it's a bit like the other, it's something you have to work at every day. And I think like that, being acknowledging that, and like, wouldn't it be lovely if we could all sort of, you know, we want very much, don't we, like neat beginnings, middles and ends, do you know what I mean? And we want people to kind of walk off into the sunset and live happily ever after. But that isn't how life works.
Mm.
So for me, yeah, every day is a kind of like battle to reprogram decades of kind of indoctrination that my worth is linked to the way I look. Like, every day I have to go, well, is it?
yeah.
Why isn't your worth attached to, I don't know, what, you know, like, I don't know, like, just to the fact you're a human being and you deserve, all human beings are equal.
If you tried to explain it to an alien, they'd think that the bigger people would have the most respect because they took up the sense.
They used to.
Yeah, like Henry VIII.
Fatness would be a sign of wealth and health and thinness was poverty and
now
a sign
it's kind
of
the other way
fertility.
Around, isn't it?
And it's not so,
fascinating. Like, try to explain that to anyone. It's stupid.
I know.
It is. Yeah, it is fascinating, and I'm sure one day. Well, you know, like, just as we look back on, like, the noughties, which I think was, like, yesterday, and it's like, no, it wasn't, babes. and some of the stuff that I look at, like, the magazine coverage of people, and I go, oh, my God, did I live through that? You know, and it's like, yeah, but I didn't think it was weird at the time.
No.
And there will be some sort of way in which we're talking now, and in 20 years' time, our children will be hosting a podcast where they pour over these clips and go, can you believe that?
So problematic.
That how problematic our parents' generation were.
Oh, Christ.
Imagine Tommy and Arlo.
Yeah, that's exactly that.
In this studio being like, our mums.
And they'll be so brave for like sort of and breaking then, their...
Yeah, and, and my daughter Edie, who will be like 10 years ahead of them, will be like, guys.
I lived through it. My mum tried to have me on her lap in that studio. Oh, man.
So how did you, with your binge eating, once then you recognised that that's what it was, that it was binge eating, did you, what did you do?
Well, I got treatment. So,
okay.
I sort of realised I had to go and work at, so it was like, oh, another thing. So I'm lucky because I went to rehab. I have like quite a lot of resources around me, you know, people. So I still see my counsellor from rehab once a month, 7 years after.
That's so nice.
That's great.
And so like I knew who to kind of, I attack it like a sort of, like I would a physical illness. Yeah. Well, I suppose it is in a way. For me, you know, I love support groups for me, like, and I mean like 12-step support groups by that, you know, like I love living in a world, like a mini micro world where people talk about this stuff. And I'm really lucky to be in recovery where people do. And that, you know, I am not the last person who got sober and then like immediately cross addicted to food. Do you know what I mean? So I had an already made kind of network around me where it was like perfectly like, oh yeah, let's talk about like, that's fine. Yeah. You know, for me, it's food. For me, it was sex. For me, it was gambling. Yeah. You know, like there's any number of things.
That's so useful that you had the community.
But also food is like different, like from alcohol. I don't have to drink alcohol to live. It may have felt like that at the time, but I do have to eat food. And so, you know, like the recovery is, you know, I suppose in, if I was to pick up a drink tonight, that would, you know, that would be a relapse or whatever. If I find myself in a binge of food, it's a bit like, okay, you know, it's not, there's not a sort of...
Yeah, because what if you were just really hungry or it was like, I know it's different, but it's harder to distinguish.
You have to kind of like, but I think also, I think it is that like instinctively getting in touch with your body and like when I want to just binge, it's like, what's going on, babes?
Do you know what? And that is what I have found this whole time is the hardest thing about recovery from any kind of eating disorder that I've had, and I've run the gamut, I've cycled through them all, is that you can't just abstain like that you can with alcohol. And like at times when I've just been on my knees with it, just desperate, thinking I just wish it was, you know, and this isn't right to say, and I don't mean that now, but I wish it was alcohol so I could just get rid of it completely. Because it's so hard to redefine a relationship. And I don't know why I'm making this all about me, but
it's your podcast, yeah.
But food has always been the most...
Can we just for a second, quickly? That is really important because as women, we always feel we need to say that when we're coming in with a perfectly valid point. Yeah. I don't want to make this all about me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's true.
I don't know if I'm making sense. Like, fuck that. Yeah. You're making perfect sense and you're not making it about you.
Fair.
You're
just
having a conversation.
But yeah, food has always been probably the most significant and fractious relationship that I've had that has ever existed in my life. And to redefine that as something healthy is so hard and something that I think I'll do for the rest of my life. And I think that's important as well. Like you're saying, we like beginnings, middle and ends. We like everything to be like come, you know, packaged up nice and neatly with a bow and it's all done and all finished. And it's just not the case, is it? Like I think I will, in different forms, I will struggle with binge eating probably my whole life, at least managing it.
And also because, it's just going, okay, but like I just, what do I have to do? I have to do today.
And I love that, yeah. And that's the 12-step mentality, yeah,
just
mentality,
today,
isn't it?
Yeah. This is not wisdom that I made
one
up.
One step at a time.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. One day at a time, 1 hour at a time, if possible, 1 minute at a time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like I don't have to think about the rest of my life because who knows? Like I don't, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen this afternoon?
Yeah.
You know, I hope nothing. Interesting.
Yeah, that would be nice.
That'd be nice.
Sweet fuck all could happen for the rest of the day. I would be delighted.
But again, I'm not in control, you know? Yeah. Like, so, deep breaths and like, we're all doing our best. We really are. Even the people we don't like, they're doing their best.
That is the most freeing thing in my life, knowing that. When someone's a twat, I'm like, oh, sad for you because that's your best.
And like, who knows what's going on in their lives?
It's really important to remember that. And annoying sometimes too.
I read something the other day, it's like, when people are twats, you have to think like, someone's got to do it, someone's got to be the twat.
Yeah.
But I was kind of like, do they though? Does someone have to be the twat?
Well, I mean, but like, they might argue that you're the twat.
But possibly.
What a twatty thing to do.
Like, possibly.
Like, I'm not saying you're, like, when I go into like, you know, there's like my point of view, there's, you know, there's someone, I remember someone saying to me, there's three versions of the truth. There's your version, there's my version, and then there's the truth.
Yeah.
That's exactly it.
It's so true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you for talking to
us. Oh, thanks. I could stay here all day.
I know. And I was going to go into something else, and then I was like, you will literally be here all
day. But I do know what I have to do this afternoon, which is some work.
Ish.
Okay.
Ish. People can buy your book.
Yes.
They can if they want. They could get it out of the library as well.
Yeah. That's nice.
That is nice.
As an author, you're like, oh, but they could also buy
it. In an ideal world.
You could get out of the library, guys.
Yes, it's available in all places that you might buy your books from.
And we will put a link in the show notes.
Thank you so
and
much.
And a link to your Instagram so people can follow you. I love following you.
Oh, I love following both of you. Oh. And you'll be... Yeah, I mean, running, they can cheer you on at London Marathon as well. You've got Brighton Marathon. You've got your run from Brighton to London. And then you've got London Marathon.
Yeah.
Your joint's going to be all right.
I'll give a joint update along the way.
It's such a long way, Bryony. You're mad.
No, that is a fucking long way.
I know. I forget.
You just wrote a book called Mad Woman.
Like, what? Why?
You're going to go show that? Because why not? I'm a size 18 to 20 and I can do this.
Yeah, you fucking can.
Do you enjoy it?
Does anyone really enjoy it? I enjoy finishing. I enjoy the end of a run. Like, yes, I did that.
Yeah. I don't know how you do it, Brian. It's weird, isn't it? Like, honestly, I've got to the point now, I'm like, why am I fucking doing this again? Again as well. Like, one time, you fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice.
I know.
And fool you fucking 10 million times. There's no hope.
Well, listen, if my joints hold up afterwards, then maybe I'll move to something else.
If you're worried about Bryony, you know you can send her an email. She takes
address
really
email
well.
Address in the show notes. Well, look, good luck with all your both of you. Good luck with your marathons. I will be cheering you both on from the comfort of my sofa.
Fair fucks.
With my popcorn. Thanks
Could
for joining
you
us.
Watch us.
I'll definitely come. Yeah, I like
Could
watching.
Could you bring the popcorn with you?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll like.
And the sofa.
I'll throw it, like,
and throw
confetti.
It into my mouth.
I'll like.
Oh, that would be nice.
Bryony, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you so much.
We've
loved having you. Again,
you're the best.
Second time.
Thank you. Bye.
Should I delete that? It's part of the Acast Creator Network.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.